Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to All About Acting. I'm usually the co-host, but tonight I guess I'm the host for tonight. Laura Jean is still on set of a film that she's doing called Space. So she should be coming on to talk hopefully fairly soon. I guess she was last week was her first time there, so we had that problem as well. But our guest tonight I've had on my show for the Independent Corner. I'm not sure if I had you on Frights the Roundtable as well, but probably have. Please welcome Dave Campfield. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing good, Jonathan. How's everything going tonight?
Good, good. So I'm planning to get more of your Cesar and Otto movies. Like I've streamed them and I've seen them, and I think you've even sent me links before too, and everything. But I'll actually be buying them as soon as I possibly can for Indie Film Cafe stuff. So prepare for, you know, more of that.
For those of you who don't know, that's the Cesar and Otto are a couple of characters. I'm the writer director, and I play Cesar in this comedy duo with my friend Paul, and they're all comedy horror films. And John and I are both in the indie scene, and that's how we know each other, I think.
Yeah. I know I've known you for a long time because I remember, didn't you have, if I'm correct, was it Cesar and Otto's, Dracula's lawyer play at Fright Fest or whatever, Fright Night?
You went to Fright Night in Kentucky?
Yes.
Were you in Kentucky for that?
I was in Kentucky for that. Were you there?
But I didn't. I went to a few of those. Maybe I wasn't there that year. So that's
what
I thought. Yeah.
No, you were not, because I do remember you telling me it was playing, but you were not able to make it that year. It was 2010.
So you were probably the one guy in the theater there and went to go see it.
I don't remember, but I remember being there and seeing it on the big screen. I don't remember how big the crowd was, but I do remember seeing it and enjoying it. Pretty funny.
You know, the thing about Fright Night, it's a great festival. They've got some of the biggest guests in the world and some of the biggest actors that are out there. And they'll have five screenings going on simultaneously. So you have this wealth of content. And, you know, sometimes they'll have a bigger film playing and a few smaller films. The smaller films, the crowds are tiny. And you go next door and there's a Robert Englund film playing and it's a full house. You're like, damn it, I want you guys in my screen. You know, so... Yeah, you know, we did the Cesar and Otto feature films. We started with Summer Camp Massacre, Deadly Xmas, Paranormal Halloween, and between those we did short films. Anything from Piggyzilla, which is about a gigantic guinea pig running amok, and Cesar and Otto Meet Dracula, Cesar and Otto Meet Dracula's Lawyer. And you know, the idea with those features was to do something that was kind of akin to the old Abbott and Costello movies, Abbott and Costello comedy horrors, like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, because as an indie filmmaker, as an indie actor, all of that, trying to find that corner of the market that's not represented as much. And I thought that was a different kind of films that I grew up watching and really enjoyed, and I wanted to do a modern-day equivalent of that, granted on a small budget with a bunch of B-movie stars. And each progressive one seemed to get more recognition than the last, but I'm at the point where we're in hold with that, and I'm about to on the precipice of making a serious film. But since this is an acting panel, enough of that crap. What are we talking about? the topic at hand.
It's interesting because you do direct, but you also act in the films as well, and I know a lot of people talk about that I'm sure you've gotten interviewed about that before, but is it kind of sometimes hard to kind of do both at the same time?
Yeah, you know, I look back at what I've done, and I think what I was doing in the beginning with this series is a little bit different than where I wound up going as an actor. You know, I played it. I was so wacky that it lacked nuance. And if you look at the later films, you know, I went from, you know, making my character sound like this, where it's like, the more words, the second, the better. And like, just like zooming through these lines to kind of adding nuance and, you know, he's not talking like that all the time because I had no objective eye as a director. And, you know, that's one of the disadvantages. If I was looking at another actor doing that, maybe I would have said, you know, slow down. You don't have to go 0 to 90 every scene. So that's one of the difficulties in directing yourself. You don't always get that objective view, and sometimes it takes time before you do. And, you know, I think where I am with the character right now, it's much better received. I remember when one of the first season of Autofilm came out, there was a critic that was saying, yeah, the film's fun, but these guys are kind of amateur. And flash forward to the next film, forgot that he ever wrote that. And I took a little bit of a different approach to the same character. He said, these guys are comedy aces. Like, there's nothing different. The other guy's exactly the same. I just nuanced it a little bit. You know, I didn't play him like he was on speed the entire time. You know, everything's got a lot of levels. You can't just give everything, you know, you can't just give everything to an individual moment because it comes off as overacting, you know, even in comedy. You know, so that's the disadvantage of directing yourself. Sometimes you don't necessarily get a clear view. And sometimes when you follow your heart, it's not necessarily the best direction to take.
Right.
You know, you have to be able to really step back. And, you know, there's advantages of seeing these things with audiences and seeing how people react and getting a much clearer view of all of that. You were saying, Jonathan?
I especially think in comedy as well that it's very easy, I feel like, for people to overact than to be subtle, more subtle, or, you know, play it real, you know, more so.
Sure. There's a lot of different kinds. As an actor, there's a lot of ways you can play comedy. You can play comedy completely on the level, just a hair heightened. You're playing as a normal person who has dramatic reactions, and there's nothing inorganic or there's nothing false about the performance. Or then you can go for farce. Almost, you know, you can see Stanley Kubrick going in this direction sometimes in the performances where everything is so heightened, you know, or better yet, you know, Three Stooges. Everything is so heightened
right.
that it barely resembles reality anymore. You know, those are two approaches you can take, you know, and I started much more zany, and I just dialed it back a little because I think it seems a little more accessible to the audience. I mean, you look at something even as outrageous as Adaptation, that Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman venture, and the performances are still very much on the level, despite how absurd the situation and the circumstances are.
Well,
so
it's more absurd because it was a movie about a writer, but it's
struggling.
About the writer but it's about the writer himself who is writing this story. But it's like, it's way too meta, but it's like even crazier than that because it's like I wrote myself into my story, and it's wondering, like, did Charlie Kaufman actually say that out loud in real life? Like, did he look at himself and go, I wrote myself into my story?
I believe the way the story went was that he was hired to write adapt the Orchid Thief, a book that was about a guy who stole flowers. And he had such a hard time adapting it that the screenplay he handed in was about himself trying to adapt that screenplay, adapt that book into a screenplay. So it's the most meta movie ever. And somehow when he hands that in to his agent, the agent didn't tell him to fuck off. The agent says, okay, I like this. He said, like, he literally thought there's no way this is going to get made. And flash forward a few years later, a few Oscar nominations for the film. But when you look at some of the scenes that with Meryl Streep that are very funny, she plays it 100% on the level. She becomes, they turn her from this dignified author and turn her into a junkie. And you look at the performance, it's right out of any other dramatic film. It's just the words that she's saying that are so absurd. We're going to have to kill him. Like when they talk about killing him. And, you know, there's an example of truly playing it straight.
Exactly. So let's go back to your work as well. So so I noticed that, like, Caesar and Otto, there's a Caesar and Otto movie, like just Caesar and Otto.
That's the Caesar and Otto feature film I don't talk much about. Yeah, that was the one that began it all. Speaking of acting, you know, these characters came out of an acting exercise that I did with my buddy. You know, Paul is somebody that I knew from childhood, the one who plays Otto. And we're both aspiring actors of Long Island, New York. And we would do sketches like anybody, any other kids who love film. You know, put the camcorder down. And two of the characters that I discovered when we were fooling around one day was Caesar and Otto. And I told them, Paul, I'm going to be a feminine cab driver who wants to be an actor. And you're going to be my mentally challenged brother. Now, that's not exactly where it ended up, but an experiment to see, like, how absurd, like, do these characters click? Is it unique? And something kind of took root with that little acting experiment. And that eventually grew into more short films. And then we did a feature film about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago. It's a $700 feature film that we shot almost entirely in Paul's apartment out in L.A. And the beauty of that, even though at the time when I made it, I was much more confident than I am looking back at the film. When I made it, I came across these great actors, Scott Aguilar and Ken McFarlane. And I used those two actors in every Caesar and Otto film that followed. Because, I mean, that was the beauty of doing it. It was sort of like a trial run of what it would be like to make a feature film with these guys. And that led to an opportunity with Camp Motion Pictures to make a comedy horror film. And Summer Camp Massacre, I told, like they said, we want to do a comedy horror, what do you have? And I said, well, I just did a feature film with these two characters on Next to No Money. What if we put those two guys, we put them into a horror film, like a summer camp setting, like a sleepaway camp. And, you know, it would be like Dumb and Dumber Meet Goes to Sleepaway Camp. And they said, write us a script. And that was the beginning of the Caesar and Otto horror comedy trilogy.
Yeah, they definitely have like a Dumb and Dumber kind of feel. But as you said, like, I guess his Paul's character was supposed to be like more mentally challenged, but definitely doesn't come off that way, especially more in the later ones.
It's that was... You know, when you look at the initial incarnation of Bugs Bunny, where he's like, hey, what's up, Doc? And everything's a little bit different. Everything's a little distorted. You look at the first Homer Simpson, he's like, Marge, he doesn't really sound like himself. It was the same kind of thing where you go through an evolution. Hell, if you even look at sitcoms, it usually takes a season or two before the characters find where they really are. Look at, you know, Taxi, Jim Ignatowski, how it was originally played in the pilot by Christopher Lloyd, is a hell of a lot different than where he went with it. Or The Honeymooners, when Ralph Cramden from Ed Norton first popped on the screen, he's not the Ed Norton that he is a season later. So it's the same process where, you know, you experiment with it. You know, he at one point did a little slow. It didn't really work as well, you know, and then you reinvent it.
Exactly. Well, that's cool. Like, you're able, like I said before to you, I think just through Messenger, but like, it's basically a lot of growth in the characters.
Yeah, you know, they feel much more like real people, whereas they went from one-dimensional characters to more or less three-dimensional characters over time with, you know, history and nuances with, when they come from someplace, they're about something, they want something. And, you know, so long as you're pushing forward and so long as you keep you know, working, you should hopefully be searching for these levels of these characters. One thing that was like a really important lesson to me in the performance of that character, which granted is a pretty broad character, I'm referring to Caesar, is I was looking back on my favorite comic actors, Tony Randall, you know, what he did with the character of Felix in The Odd Couple, is a lot more nuanced than you might think. You know, my younger self didn't see how nuanced he was. And looking at him now, trying to be an actor at the level that, you know, Randall was, who's really one of the, who's truly an incredible comic actor, was that he did not play every scene like a lunatic. He very specifically chose where he would do that. You could say the same thing about Jason Alexander in Seinfeld. You know, for the most part, they're level, they're everyday, they're relatable. And then they chose those moments where they're going to lose it, you know, and those are funny. But if they played it at that level the entire time, it'd get annoying, you know. And that was the lesson of my early work versus where I, you know, ultimately, you know, took the characters and took the franchise.
Definitely. Well, that also brings me up to a good question about you as an actor. I mean, you're obviously always trying to grow as an actor and everything. But in the beginning, like, did you feel that that was eventually going to happen, or did you were you just like enjoying it and just having fun?
I thought my initial incarnation was great, and I couldn't understand why some people were so bothered by it. You know, because I put that film out there. I put Summer Camp out there. I was like, wow, some people really fucking hate my character. Like, some people like say it's Clyde, and other people had a real love-hate reaction. And I didn't anticipate that. And the dumb thing would be for me to just be mad at all those people who say the negative things and just act like I'm a brilliant actor and they don't get it. But try to understand where they're coming from and find a way to play it so that it worked for more people and look at those that everybody finds effective and good and learn from them. You know, Summer Camp, that one's out there. That one's, if anybody's interested, you know, Kings of Horror hosts it now. You know, that so you can see that first one that we did on YouTube. And that film was the debut. Twice in my career now, I've cast actors in their first feature film that went on to be very big. And that film, you can see Trey Byers, who went on to play the son of Andre, the son of Lucius Fox. Not Lucius Fox, it's Batman. Lucius on that show Empire. You know, multiple millions of viewers a week. He's one of the leading roles of that show. And I cast him on a film he knew he was getting paid nothing for, and he was just starting out. And I could see in him all those traits that served him well later in his career. You know, he, in both cases, the people that I cast in their first film, you could see I had a great feeling that they had potential to make it. And they did. They both did. They both successful working actors. In the case of Trey, it's like he wanted, it wasn't just like I know what I'm doing and you don't. It was like there's that want to be as good as you can, and that persistence and really analyzing and breaking down a scene together, and you know, there was a real depth, even though he was only, I think he was 20, 21 when I cast him, and all those instincts served him right. And one day he'll be an Emmy or Oscar nominee. And the other guy, like I, the film I made before, I had a serious film before I made Summer Camp. And that was the first film I had ever made. And the supporting character in that, played by Peter Scanavito, who years later stars now on Law & Order SVU. And my impression of him was so you might see that. I think you watch the show a lot more than I do. What is his character?
Yeah,
I just know he's this tall thin guy from you know, who's got this really strong New York accent, which is fake because he's from Colorado. Doesn't sound anything like that. So Mr. Carver, I was I just remember thinking,
wait,
like, when I
you,
saw
are
him
you
on the show,
that TV lies to you?
That he what?
I'm saying, does TV lie to you? Is that what you're saying?
TV in general is nothing but lies. It's an illusion. It's smoke and mirrors. Even reality programming, but the audience clearly knows that. Reality programming.
Right.
It doesn't have all that much reality. But, what was funny is Pete was a kid from – Peter Scannavino was a kid from Colorado, and I was the first film he ever auditioned for. And my reaction to him was he doesn't look like the character, but there's something very unique about him. And I thought his career was going to go in the direction more of a Sean Penn, because when you look at his face, he's got kind of a Sean Penn quality. And frankly – I think the best is still ahead of him, because I think in Law and Order, he just plays this kind of, he's playing a cop. There's not that kind of, he's a really unique guy. And I'm looking forward to, when he's out of, SVU, the kind of stuff he can take on. Look at some of the other earlier films that he did in his filmography. He played like a stoner like nobody else. As a matter of fact, I think he was on the show playing other characters before he played that character.
And I also want to mention that you also got to, for your first film and for later on for other films, you got to work with Felissa Rose. And, she just loves working with you, I guess. Like, she's worked with you a ton of times. And
film I've done with her. Keep in mind, we didn't live all that far from each other. I'm on the set of a commercial one day out on Long Island before I ever made my debut film, and talking to this nice girl across from me, this nice woman across from me. And I was telling her about this feature film when I was trying to get off the ground. She said, well, look me up. Give me a call. That sounds really interesting. I look her up, and son of a bitch, she's Angela Baker. I had no idea. And we became very friendly, and it took a while to get that first film off the ground. She was always supportive. She said, when you make it, I'm there. And she was. And we developed a friendship, and she's a huge part of why I get the great supporting cast in my films. Is like, she said, you want Sean Whalen? I could get Sean Whalen. You want Tiffany Shepis? Let me talk to her. Let me get her. She, as a producer, as a friend, as a producer, has really been able to do a lot. And few people are quite the human dynamo that she is. If you see her, did an event out in Huntington, New York, near where I live, and she invited me out to go see her. She is like nonstop energy and positivity. It blows my mind. Because I think, like the rest of us, I don't know if I'm signing the autographs, which will never happen like the way it does with her, at least at the moment. At one point, I'm like, what? Here, go away. And she never loses her, like, her joy. So mm-hmm. few people are as comfortable in a crowd or hold a crowd like she does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually was at a convention with her. Actually, Tiffany Shepis was there as well. And so was Deborah Sean. And it was really cool just seeing all three of those ladies together. They, like, had tables all next to each other, and they were all talking and having a blast. And, I mean,
All three of them were in. All three of them were in Paranormal Halloween. Coincidentally.
There you go.
Yeah, and Debbie was not a connection through Felissa. Debbie was a connection through my friend Stephen, who says you've got to meet her before I even knew who Debbie was. And we've been working ever since. I've been fortunate. A lot of making films and is who and not coming off like a psychopath.
And so were you? Where people like, say, I mean. Were you into the indie horror scene?
I loved horror. I loved the first thing that I ever saw at an amusement park was The Haunted House. I was into the macabre and horror. I would watch The Shining and Halloween on television growing up. Granted, edited for TV, it still terrified the hell out of me. And as I got a little bit older, I discovered some of the more of the underground films. I was, but then meeting everybody as I went forth making indie films only got me more into it, I fall in love with films like Silent Night, Deadly Night, and, more of the cult movies. So I was,
Evil.
And I only became more so over the, what's up?
Like, have you ever seen Christmas Evil?
I know of Christmas Evil, but I haven't seen Christmas Evil. I think one of the critics referenced that. Well, is that your film, Donovan?
Well, no, it's not my film. My
no, I've definitely heard of Christmas Evil.
I want to talk, because we talked earlier through Messenger, we were talking about, apparently you have an Inside the Actor's Studio story you'd like to tell.
Oh, yeah, it was supposed to be steadily brought up, Jonathan. It was supposed to be like, so I have an actor's studio. You have any stories related to that? You weren't just supposed to say I had a story. Yes, I do have a story. Thank you for asking. No, what happened was, there was a point, it was right around the time I was making my first feature. I think it was on a hiatus. I was waiting for the sound designer to take care of things. So I'm like, I got to get some stuff done. You know, I got to advance my career however possible. I jump into local theater, right? And it's in my town. I go on audition. This is a humiliating story. This starts off very humiliating. I'm aware of that. Here, priding myself as an actor who knows what he's doing. In my early 20s, I audition for this role, and I don't get it. You know how many people I was trying out against? One. So there's two of us.
God.
I don't get it. It's non-paying community theater. It is as low, as non-competitive as it gets, and holy shit, I didn't get the part. And they call me a day later, listen, the guy is supposed to play the role. He can't do it. So how about you play it? Thank you for the confidence, vote of confidence. Sure. Basically, I'm the only person you have to choose from. So I go and I'm doing this play for about a week. And, you know, I feel okay with it. I haven't really done a role like this in there. And, you know, just imagine the director of this play, his character, he's like got these huge glasses, late 60s. When he would look at his script, he'd put it right up against his eyes to look at it. And I actually used that trait as Caesar in a later film. And he said, listen, when you do these lines, could you be more emphatic? You know, like really fold your hands around, like really kick your feet, you know, because that's what the audience wants. And I couldn't overact the way that he wanted, which is ironic because my character Caesar that I did later, you know, was totally overdramatic. But I was having such a hard time, you know, just doing what he wanted, and he calls me a day later to fire me. So I got fired from community theater. I was up against nobody. I was getting paid nothing, and they fucking fired me. So my confidence goes from a moderate level to ground zero. I'm like, I thought I knew what I was doing. Like, I just wanted to be a naturalistic actor, and I failed in the eyes of this guy. A year passes. A friend of mine says, my friend Bob, you know, he's like kind of more of like a New York guy. He says, but, you know, Dave, I'm going to be auditioning for the Actors Studio, and I need a scene partner, and I thought maybe it'd be good to do a scene with. Like, Bob, look, I got fired from, like, community theater last year. What am I going to do with the Actors Studio? I mean, seriously, like, he's like, hey, don't make it about you. Make it about me. It's like, do the scene with me. You know, it's going to help me out. I need a scene partner. It's my fourth time going to the studio. Just help me out. Like, you know, you're right. I shouldn't even take this seriously. It doesn't matter, like, I'm helping you out, and you know what? We get to work on a scene, and that's good enough for me. Spell a while on the scene, Lloyd and Lee, playing two actors who can't get their shit together. We go into the city, and it's like out of a scene from a movie, because all we can see in the city is like a sea of empty seats and three silhouettes in the front row looking at us. And the scene begins with us sounding like we don't know what we're doing, and literally, the dialogue is, do you mean to tell me that we came all the way out here and now we're not going to do the scene now? That was the beginning of the scene. And they bought it. And they seemed to like it. And we run out after. Bob runs out after me and says, this is the first time they didn't stop me. Meaning, his other auditions, they said, after 10 seconds, we've seen enough. It's like, okay, that's good, whatever. A couple days later, he calls me up. He says, I got your letter in the mail. Yeah. Did you open it? I said, no, it says, I just got my fifth rejection. What about you? I said, I haven't opened my letter. I don't want to know what's in it. Dave, it would make me feel so much better if you got rejected too. Of course I got rejected. I got fucking fired from community theater. What do you think? So, okay, you know, you want to hear me? You want to hear me read the letter? You want to hear me tell you like how I got rejected too? Fine. And I open up the letter. And it says, Dear Mr. Campfield, the actor studio is very impressed with your audition. I'd like the opportunity to see you at your earliest convenience. How in 1 year's time did I go from so bad that I got fired from community theater, not even just like regional, like we're talking like sub-level community theater, to passing my actor studio audition? You know what that goes to tell you, Jonathan? No one knows
what?
No one knows fucking anything. No one. So that's my actor studio story.
That is actually a William Goldman line, too. Nobody knows anything. And it's very true.
Yeah. You know, you got to follow your heart. You got to follow your instinct. You got to do your best. You know, take criticism, but don't take it too seriously. Don't take praise too seriously because, it, you know, you get both. And just do your absolute best and be real. And that's the best I could do. You know, like I'm working on another feature film right now, and my whole attitude going into it is I want everything, every performance to just be grounded and authentic. You don't want it to be, you know, you don't want it to sound like actors reciting dialogue. You don't want it to look like actors hitting their marks. You just want it to be naturalistic. You want it to be real, like as real as you and I talking right now. And I'm going to put everything into it to make sure that's where it is, because I'm tired of looking at some indie films where it's clear that they could have used a few more takes. In the digital age, it's very surprising to me that sometimes people settle as much as they do, you know, when they could have easily, you know, if the actor had a better take in them, do that extra take, you know, do those exercises that get you into that moment more. There's a great story when I was listening to the commentary of Sinister, where there was an argument between Ethan Hawke's character and his wife that wasn't working. And the director said, look, this doesn't feel real to me. And in the scene, Hawke was supposed to be digging up something in the backyard, runs into the kitchen, is washing his hands off. When they had done the scene prior, he hadn't he pantomimed the digging. And so apparently, as the director said, is it? He dirtied his hands, rub them all up like they would when he was going to be really dirty. Use that as a starting point from the scene. They roll camera, and when he walks in the kitchen, he's really washing his hands off because his hands are actually dirty. And just that action course-corrected the scene. So if you find those actions, those activities, those things where so you stop pantomiming and you stop really being in the moment, I mean, so you can start really being in the moment, you know, that those are the keys that I continue to look for in any given scene. Oh, by the way, I could curse on this podcast because I have already, right? It's fine?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really dark.
You want to hear the time? You want to hear the time that my 83-year-old acting teacher, a sweet old lady, told me to go fuck myself?
Of course.
I will tell you, Jonathan. So, especially when I was in my early 20s, I like to push buttons. You know, like, I feel like I knew it all. I didn't, whatever. Again, I didn't play nice with others because, you know, so I was then. And I'm in this local acting class, and this woman, Lillian, she was so pretentious. I've been in 100 films, and I've learned a lot about acting. And, like, this woman was so false, and she was telling us about how to be natural. And we had this acting exercise where they stood the bunch of us up in a line. Like, we got the class of 10 of us. So, Comet, I want you to say the line. My arm is really killing me. And then you say it to David. David says it to the actor next to him. And we just continue this up and down. And how many different ways we can say this? And there was good little exercises like that. I'm like, oh, I like this class. You know, my arm hurts. And then at one point, she didn't like what I did, which was, David, stand up in front of the class. And once point off to something in the distance and say, what is that? Okay, and I said, what is that? She says, wait, Did you really point at something? What does that matter? No, did you really point at something? Well, isn't the idea to just look like I really pointed at something? So therefore, if I do point at something and I'm saying that, that's the right way to do it.
Oh, don't give me that method acting bullshit. You're supposed to imagine it.
So she's telling me that I sounded too real, essentially. And then I do this half-assed version of the line, which is, what is that? She said, okay, good. My methodology is, don't fucking imagine. If you can't feel real, then really address something in your immediate environment and act off of that. Always have something so it's not something distant and vague in your head. Really be reacting off of something. And I learned that because I saw how badly the other approach worked in this class that I paid a lot of money for.
Right. But, you know, that's definitely a thing because here, you know, one of my biggest problems I guess really as an actor, what you want to do, right? It's up to you to bring the character to life, you know, the way that feels good for you. But with acting classes, you know, you get a lady like that who has a specific thing to teach you guys, right? But
I didn't tell you why she told me to go F myself, actually.
What?
I didn't actually tell you why she told me to go F herself.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, go
hear that part.
I didn't mean to interrupt that thought. We want to backtrack to that. But you were saying when you have an acting class, what was it that you were saying?
Well, basically, when you're doing an acting class, you're kind of in the throes of the teacher, you know, right? So the teacher will tell you one thing, and then another teacher, if you went to another place, would tell you something different, you know? But really what it boils down to in the end is those classes are great, but, like, you as a actor have to kind of develop your own personality, your own, you know, you have to do what's right with you.
Ideally, you know, to be malleable is a great thing, to be able to kind of roll with what's being said. So, yeah, one teacher, it's like having different directors. One director wants you to be broad. One director wants you to be subtle. To be able to adjust to all of it is the idea. I'm trying to do that. Like, there was a good director that just offered me this role about a year ago, and I actually was so outside of what I do as an actor. It was a good role, but it was almost like Shakespearean in its dialect. But I said, look, I don't think I'm the right guy for this. And, you know, maybe if I was more diverse, like, I could have taken that on. But, you know, we have the things that work for us, and some people's range is wider than others. And in this particular case, my range wasn't wide enough. But back to Lillian, my acting teacher. So she had said in the first class, you know, that I've been in 80 films. And so I did what any diligent student should do when a teacher makes a big claim like that. And that is to look it up. And you know how many films she was in, according to the thing called the internet? Zero.
Zero.
So I'm guessing she was an extra in these films. Just coming off like this big prom, hey, the biggest acting she's doing in her life is playing a teacher. And
right.
So when she was like yelling at me about method acting bullshit and I've seen people like you before. She's what she's telling me, my 23-year-old self. I've seen people come in before. They think they know all of it, and they don't know nothing, and they went nowhere. I said, well, that's funny that you say that, because you claim you're the 83 films, and you've done nothing. And there's a pause in the class. It's like a scene out of a sitcom. Like, everybody pauses and looks at each other, and there's a comfortable silence of people trying to, like, adjusting their ties that aren't there. And she says, oh, fuck you. Literally told me to go fuck myself. So I stand up and I feel like I'm in high school about to I stand up like in defensive, like I'm going to fight you mode. And I walk up to this teacher, like with my chest out. I said, what do you say to me? It was absurd. The whole thing was absurd. And looking back then she just backed off and said, I'm just playing. She wasn't playing. looking back, what is it? It's just like my ego is sensitive, her ego is sensitive, you know. At least I had youth on my side to blame for that. But, you know, it's the journey. Life's the journey we take, and we make a whole lot of mistakes and just learn from them. You know, and without those mistakes that we make, we don't wind up never, you know, we'll not grow as actors and not grow as people. So, yeah, embrace your mistakes is what I say.
Well, I just want to thank you so much. I know you said you didn't have a lot of time, so I didn't want to keep you here for much longer. But tell us, what have you been up to lately?
I'm working on revising a script that I've been working on for about 10 years called Awaken the Reaper. You know, it's been I try to write a new draft. I get sidetracked by another film. I do another draft, and it's become a very personal story for me. And basically, I'm trying not to make a film on the kinds of tiny budgets that I have. I'm trying to raise enough budget to give it the production values that it needs, and hopefully tell a horror story that's not like all the other horror stories. You know, a horror story that where people are relatable, you know, like, you know, all the characters. I mean, even in a film like Scream, that's a good film. Those characters are pretty heightened. And it's almost like a little soap opera-ish. It's not the life that I know. I'm trying to set a standard that's in the world that we know that doesn't deal with teenagers. It's about people who are over 30 and they haven't gotten to where they want to be in life and they feel like they have arrested development. Being regretful of the past and afraid of the future. It's about a guy who has agoraphobia that can't leave his room, or can't leave his parents' house. He's going nowhere in life. He's got these dreams and talent and ambition. And he just finds himself in one place. He's having these visions of the, he's having these surreal visions of the Reaper. And that's more of this, you know, what's really happening in the story of life. And, you know, that for a horror film to be effective, you have to believe it. And I really try to avoid those kinds of twists and turns in a story like this that just stretch all credulity and that just stretch all reality. And hopefully, I have a film that's relatable, that's scary, and that's going to feel different than what genre usually offers. And hopefully I won't run into the criticism, well, it's not enough like those other horror films. Because the idea is always like, you know, try to bring something different to the table. And I've just every couple of years I do another draft on this thing, and it's just, you know, almost become autobiographical in a way, you know, with elements of the stories and characters.
Well, good luck with that. That's awesome.
Thanks. You know, I just gotta. Felissa was saying that she wanted to help produce, and hopefully she can. And I'm actively, you know, I'm trying something a little bit different to get more producing partners on this. I'm actually doing an audio production of the screenplay and presenting that to prospective producers in the hope that they can hear this and really get a sense of what the story is going to be, you know, between music, sound effects, performance.
Ooh. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, you know, and there's no question about, you know, because I write screenplays that are a little technical, and for, you know, for someone who doesn't read screenplays, it gets a little confusing. It's basically my way of getting all those dentists and people who don't usually invest to get a real idea of what this movie is going to feel like. So, you know, we got about a third of the funding and, you know, like, promised, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Well, once again, I wish you luck on that, because that's awesome. I look forward to hearing more about it at another time.
Absolutely. I'm just waiting for your co-host to chime in.
Well, yeah, there's no callers, and Laura is not available, I guess. For this
I can't
episode,
leave you hanging, Jonathan.
What?
I can't. I might
no,
have something.
Thought,
I might have
probably,
something. I said I can't leave you hanging. I can't let you. Just you're gonna do the rest of the show by yourself. I have to be here.
Oh, no, I'm just gonna end it. So, in a little bit, but it's okay. It works. It'll be like 50 minutes long, which will be perfect.
Okay.
So about that, but I just like let everybody know where they can reach you.
Sure. I mean, you know, like I just type in Dave Campfield on Facebook, you know, DaveCampfield. And yeah, I chat with anybody. So if you want to, you know, talk film, talk shop, you know, feel free to. And, you know, fourthhorizoncinema.com is my website. You can see trailers for the features that I've done. And that's pretty much it. Or you can, I'm on Twitter as Dave Campfield. Twitter.com/DaveCampfield, no space or lines or dots or what have you.
Do you tweet much?
Yeah, not a whole lot, but I'm on there. You know, once in a while, maybe like once a week I tweet. If I start working more, if I'm on set more with like stuff, I'll tweet more. But at the moment, I just tweet occasionally. Like, there's Facebook out there. How many social medias can you be on? You got to be on Instagram. You got to be on Twitter. You got to be on this and that. You know, like, you can't spend your life just on social media. It's taking up too much time. That's creative time, you could ask.
Right. No, definitely. But it does really help, especially if you have, like, a lot of followers or whatever. If you want to continue with a lot of doing acting, you know, in, like, Hollywood or something, they really, for some reason, they really look at that. Like, I know some.
Yeah,
I
absolutely hate that aspect. I don't want to have to be fighting for numbers to justify my experience. So I could be talentless and have a million followers. I mean, not that, you know, that doesn't go necessarily hand in hand, but it's about numbers versus content. And that's really scary to me. That's concerning. You know, it's almost like I almost wish I was doing this before the age of, of social media was happening. So we weren't just, you know, we weren't using that to justify our existence. Look, I have 150,000 followers, so therefore I know what I'm doing, right? You know, some
right.
people just have a lot of followers and interest because they are controversial. You know, that doesn't mean anything.
Oh, for sure.
So,
no, I agree.
You're right. So I should plunk down a few $1,000 and buy some followers, and maybe I'll look more important than I am.
Well, you know, that really bugs me sometimes because I've seen that. I'm not going to name any names, but there was a, you know, an actress, you know, and she's still out there doing stuff. But she had actually bought followers on Twitter. And, you know, and the problem is, like, the way that they buy the followers and everything, like, you automatically get added to their account. And then when somebody sees, like, I never added this person, they unfollow the person, you know? And I think it's just a very messed up kind of thing, you know, to do.
Bad Twitter etiquette, really bad Twitter etiquette, and I've experienced this a lot. Someone will, you know, and I don't go on there that often, but someone will friend you and like, all right, I'll friend them back, boom. And then within a couple of weeks, they unfriend you. So they're just hoping that they're adding to their numbers. This is insanity to me. All I am to you is a number. You want me to follow you to make you look important. Well, how about you fucking earn that? You know, how about you do something that requires talent and then just have Twitter's hopefully people follow you naturally. You know, it's almost like, you know, when Frank Sinatra was first making it onto the scene, girls were hired to run after him screaming in the hopes that real girls will go on their own and follow, which they did. So it shows you we got a herd mentality sometimes of, well, people are following that person. I better follow them too. And that's stupid.
Well, you know what? Speaking of people who follow and unfollow, the Asylum, the company that does Sharknado and everything, they've done that to me in the past. And so what I'll do is I'll just unfollow them after a little bit, you know, right? Like, because you know, they would follow me, so I would follow them, and then they'd unfollow me. So later I unfollowed them, and then they refollowed me recently, and I'm not following them back. I'm not following, I'm not playing that game anymore.
I just want this stuff to be about the work, you know, being a cool person and being like a decent person and doing good work. And that's it, you know, like in getting it seen. I mean, we play these social media games and it's frustrating. I don't, it should be, it's separate of what you do. It adds an extra complication to what my ability to tweet well and to be keep constant access to who's following me and that. What does that have to do with my filmmaking or my acting? You know, it's just,
well, no,
I want to hire
definitely
somebody to do that. But the last thing people want to listen about is just personal frustrations and social media.
Well,
just be good people, have fun.
And a lot of people struggle with it as independent actors and even people out there doing, like, you know, SAG stuff. I mean, they have to go out and, make, you know what I mean? They have to go out there and they have to get their name out there as hard as they can, you know?
Yeah, you know, Daisy Ridley had done a couple of indie films before being cast in the biggest grossing domestic film of all time. She had less Twitter followers than I did when she was cast in Star Wars. And that comes around and changes everything. So one night, no one knows who the hell you are or cares. And the next day, you've got close to 1 million followers. So that's kind of the nature of the business, you know. And I try not to stress about it too much, try not to stress about numbers. They are what they are. Yeah, hopefully it all turns around one day.
I heard this story that do you ever watch Game of Thrones?
Not as much as all my friends. Very little, surprisingly, because it's such a huge thing. And I'm in the geek culture. I'm a geek. But I haven't really seen him.
Well, Sophie,
I know, for shame,
Turner, who was also in, she was in an independent horror film, Josie, that's out and everything. But she actually had, like, won the part of Sansa Stark in Game of Thrones because she had more Instagram followers than the person she auditioned.
I think that's an atrocity. That is everything against what good acting is about.
It's funny because, like, she even
said that the
girl
was a better
actor,
Jonathan, I was going to give you the part, but I'm giving it to a guy with a bigger dick. How about that? It's just, you know, that's fair, right? That's a real assessment of your talent.
Well, it was also funny. There was a skit on, I forgot what it was. I think it was on YouTube. I saw it, but I don't know where it was from. But it had a bunch of British actors, and it had was it Lena Headey and Amelia Clarke in it, and they were doing auditions, you know, right? And they were showing what's wrong with auditions. So they were showing all these different reasons why women get turned down for roles, you know, and everything. And it was funny because it was so true, you know. Like the things they were like, can you be fat but skinny? You know, right? Like, what? You know, things like that. Like
things that are not winnable. You know, I guess the idea is, just get out there a lot, do a lot of work, say yes when people offer for the most part, so long as you, you know, you're copacetic, and yeah, maybe one day people notice. And if they don't, well, whatever. It was a good run. but hey, you know what, a friend of mine's doing really well. As a matter of fact, there was a guy that spent a lot of time on his films, and now he got a big break with History Channel, and he asked me to be part of his show, and I did some crew work, and I was a reenactor on a show that he did for History Channel called Dark Files. And here's a guy that put the time in, put the work in, and, you know, and he was rewarded for it. And he's going on to do other stuff, and yeah, maybe he'll tap me on the shoulder again. You know, so hoping for that. And actually, I'm just that's on my mind is I would love to, you know, if this Reaper song got off the ground, that'd be like my number one goal right now. You know, after 10, you imagine working on one project for 10 years, at a certain point, you're like, I've got to make this. And that's, you know, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. We did longer than you were expecting.
Yeah, it was a little change of plans, you know, like, because you had a co-host, and I was going to go take care of something else, but without the co-host, I'm like, all right, man, I'll stick around.
I'm very happy that, you know, four more people to go out there and, you know, be on set right now.
It's good to be
on. I'm actually changing the, saving the new thing where it says join host for the night, Jonathan Moody, as a job with actor, filmmaker, Dave Campfield, you know? So it's not misleading. I'm very happy that Laura is out there doing that stuff because that's the point of being on a show like this is having people who are actually out there.
To talk about experience.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much. And, is there anything you want to let people know about before you go?
I love all of you. That's it. But thank you for the opportunity to talk to the audience.
I love you all. You know, that's the sweetest. But, you know, thing that probably any of the actors on the show have ever said to the audience. You know.
Most of the actors say, I love myself.
I hate to say it, but it is a little bit of an ego thing, technically, acting. Because who else in their right mind would think that people just want to see them for, you know, an hour and a half or whatever, you know? Like, gotta have a little bit of an ego. A little bit. Yeah. But anyway, thank you so much, Dave. Are you still on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hello?
Oh. Hey, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Like, I can hear you earlier. I was like, uh-oh. They already,
you're still on
the thing, so here. So. But yeah, thank you so much, and we'll definitely have you back on sometime to talk more about the stuff that you're up to recently.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. You have a great night.
All right, you too. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, everybody, that was Dave Campfield. Next week, I'm not sure who we're going to have on again. We got to start getting that figured out before the next one. So I'm going to try to work on that this week. Things may change because I just got a new job, so things may change here on the show. But stick with it. And hopefully Laura Jean will be back next week for whatever episode we end up doing next week. All right. Have a great night. Bye.